Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
QLP. Tonight, our very special guest is Lynn Spiegelmeyer Vitti. Ms. Vitti was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. She's a lecturer emerita in the writing program at Wellesley College. A graduate of Mercy High School in Baltimore, she attended the College of Notre Dame of Maryland and received her BA cum laude in English Literature from Barnard College. After teaching high school English for several years in Stamford, Connecticut and Brookline, Massachusetts, she earned her Ph.D. and J.D. from Boston College. Vitti has authored numerous academic articles on legal topics, composition theory, and literature and media. Her first chapbook, Baltimore Girls, was published in March 2017, and her second collection, the Glamorshire Bible, was published in 2018, both by Finishing Line Press. She's also the author of the poetry chapbook, micro-chapbook, Origami Poems Project 2017. Her poetry, nonfiction, and fiction have appeared in over 100 online and print journals and anthologies, including The Wire, Urban Decay and American Television, 2009, The Baltimore Sun, The Musée Boucher, The Patterson Review, The Little Patuxent Review, Drunk Monkeys, Cultured Vultures, Incandescent Mind, and Right Hand Pointing. She won honorable mention in the 2015 Allen Ginsberg Poetry Contest, the 2017 Joe Gouveia Poetry Contest, and the 2015 Glimmer Train Short Fiction Contest. She has read her work at Gallery 55, Natick, Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Poetry Festival, Bird in Hand, Ivy Bookshop, Baltimore, Maryland, Little Patuxent Review, Book Culture Bookstore, New York, New York, Boston Public Library, Westwood, Massachusetts Public Library, Wellfleet, Massachusetts Public Library, Ferguson Library, Stamford, Connecticut, Mercy High School, Baltimore, Maryland, Enoch Pratt Library, Baltimore, Maryland, Dover, Maryland Public Library, the New England Mobile Book Fair, Newton, Massachusetts, Wellesley College, Old Frog Pond Farm Plain Air Poetry, Harvard, Massachusetts, Charleston Retirement Community, Catonsville, Maryland, and Lewisburg Cottages, County Mayo, Ireland. She can be found blogging at stillinschool.wordpress.com. Lynn Vitti is our special guest tonight. Lynn will join us momentarily. So what I'd like to do in advance of Lynn joining us is to play several pieces of poetry, to play them through the vocal, through vocalization. The first piece is by Lee Poe, 7:42 to 7:44. Amongst the flowers, I am alone with my pot of wine, drinking by myself, then lifting my cup, I ask the moon to drink with me. Its reflection and mine in the cup, just the three of us. Then I sigh, for the moon cannot drink, and my shadow goes emptily along with me, never saying a word. With no other friends here, I can but use these two for company in the time of happiness. I too must be happy with all around me. I sit and sing, and as if the moon accompanies me. Then if I dance, it is my shadow that dances along with me. While still not drunk, I am glad to make the moon and my shadow into friends. But then when I have drunk too much, we all part. Yet these are friends I can always count on, and these who have no emotion whatever. I hope that one day we three will meet again deep in the Milky Way, alone and drinking under the moon. Lucille Clifton, Good Times. My daddy has paid the rent, and the insurance man is gone. And the lights is back on, and my Uncle Brut has hit for $1 straight, and they is good times, good times, good times. My mama has made bread, and Grandpa has come, and everybody is drunk and dancing in the kitchen and singing in the kitchen. Of these is good times, good times, good times. Oh, children, think about the good times. Louise Clifton, 1969. William Wordsworth wrote a piece, Lines Written in Early Spring. I heard a thousand blended notes while in a grove I sate reclined, in that sweet mood when pleasant thoughts bring sad thoughts to mind. To her fair works did nature link the human soul that through me ran, and much it grieved my heart to think what man has made of man. Through primrose tufts in that green bower, the periwinkle trailed his wreaths, and 'tis my faith that every flower endures the arid breeze. The birds around me hopped and played, their thoughts and I cannot measure, but the least motion which they made it seemed a thrill of pleasure. The budding twigs spread out their fan to catch the breezy air, and I must think, do all I can, that there was pleasure there. If disbelief from heaven be sent, if such be nature's holy plan, I have not reason to lament what man has made of man. William Wordsworth. Here's a piece that I like. The new Poetry Handbook by Mark Strand. If a man understands a poem, he shall have troubles. If a man lives with a poem, he shall die lonely. If a man lives with two poems, he shall be unfaithful to one. If a man conceives of a poem, he shall have one less child. If a man conceives of two poems, he shall have two children less. If a man wears a crown on his head as he writes, he shall be found out. If a man wears no crown on his head as he writes, he shall deceive no one but himself. If a man gets angry at a poem, he shall be scorned by men. If a man continues to be angry at a poem, he shall be scorned by women. If a man publicly denounces poetry, his shoes will fill with urine. If a man gives up poetry for power, he shall have lots of power. If a man brags about his poems, he shall be loved by fools. If a man brags about his poems and love fools, he shall write no more. If a man craves attention because of his poems, he shall be like a jackass in the moonlight. If a man writes a poem and praises the poem of a fellow, he shall have a beautiful mistress. If a man writes a poem and praises the poem of a fellow overly, he shall drive his mistress away. If a man claims the poem of another, his heart shall double in size. If a man lets his poems go naked, he shall fear death. If a man fears death, he shall be saved by his poems. If a man does not fear death, he may or may not be saved by his poems. If a man finishes a poem, he shall be bathed in the blank wake of his passion and be kissed by white paper. Mark Strand, A New Poetry Handbook. Dylan Thomas, Do Not Go Gentle. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men are at the end, no dark is right. Because their words have forked no lightning day, do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight Blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there is the sad height. Curse, bless me now. With your fish tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. We'll be right back. Number is 646-787-1631. Please call in to speak with Lynn Vitti. She'll be with us momentarily. I'd like to recite another piece that's in my book, When Cherry Blossoms Fall on Black Skin. It should be available in early 2019. It was an inauspicious day when he decided to unloosen life's leash. His leash had become too tight, collaring his neck with no regard for feelings or words bottled up in his throat. He couldn't scream or ask for release to romp, play, or run free. He couldn't pull and lunge at everything or, heaven forbid, speak to Mrs. June Jackson, the beaten-down young woman who often blushed in his presence. So he packed up his belongings in a brown paper-stained bag, opened his unguarded gate, and ran away. Here's a piece that I wrote for my father. I can remember Sunday mornings right before church when the whole family would get together to eat. We'd all hustle to the kitchen table in search of our favorite seat. There we would patiently wait until the food was on the table. We'd silently give thanks to God for making all things able. Go ahead and eat, our mama would say. But remember always to be thankful to the Lord for the day. In the kitchen you could hear the loud clicking of plates, spoons, and knives as we all scrambled for the grits, eggs, and bacon that we knew would keep our young bodies alive. Sometimes the noise in the kitchen was so great, it would make you wonder what we were doing to those plates. No matter how loud we got on those Sunday mornings, there was one sound that came through indisputably clear. It was the booming voice of our daddy who had taken his plate into the den. He knew that he could not eat in peace in the kitchen because it often sounded like a freight train had roared in. Throw me another biscuit around the corner, if you please, our daddy would say. And just like the great Satchel Paige, we'd fight to see who would even want to sell one his way. Our daddy was a big old tall and burly black man who never had to worry about a biscuit when it went sailing through the air. He would catch it in the palm of his hand with his usual style and flair. You see, our daddy, as a younger man, had aspirations of becoming a great baseball star. He played shortstop and left field for the Rockingham Giants and High Point Braves, so his athletic abilities were known both near and far. Like many black men whose lives take a sudden turn, a career in baseball became one that he'd forever yearn, so when he'd holler, throw me another biscuit around the corner, if you please, one of us would shift sideways, step and throw, all of us hoping to dear Lord that the biscuit didn't overshoot him, bounce and hit the floor. Daddy, come into the kitchen and get a biscuit, my mama would say. No, he'd reply, I can catch it like I did back in the day. Daddy, we'd say, your hands look like they can't take it anymore. Yeah, I know, he'd wistfully say, but I can catch a biscuit still like a pro. Although our father's hands were jet black leathery hands, we'd have been numbered. It's a very powerful piece for me. Which had been numbed and stiffened by years of hard work, toil, and sweat, we also knew that his strong black hands had not given up yet. So throw me another biscuit around the corner, if you please, while I thank the Lord for the biscuit that I'm about to receive. That was throw me another biscuit around the corner, if you please. I'd like to read a piece by Miss Vitti. Called Greyhounds. Our Uber driver says we don't look like bus people. Here at the depot, in a tangle of shopping center roads, are families, a man in a wheelchair, and a row along the wall. We get tags for the suitcases, hug our backpacks close like the Uber driver said to. The ticket holders clutch their belongings, balancing them in their laps. Cell phones, Walmart bags stuffed with packages of veggie sticks, nacho chips. The station smells of something unidentifiable. Maybe stale food, matted hair, layers of clothes that need laundering. Those with nothing but time and $27 take the bus from Austin to Laredo, an all-day affair. We join the snaking line, inch our way to the man in the day-glow vest. Too old to be working, he stows our gear in the belly of the bus. Inside, the bus smells like a vacation station. Worn, old, sweat-infused, we slide into vacant seats, watch the parade of passengers. The driver paces the aisle, speaking English first, then Spanish. He shouts the rules. No alcohol, no smoking, no drugs. It is not Simon and Garfunkel. We've not gone to look for America. We've only wanted to see the Alamo and the missions. We ride with the survivors whose teeth and skin show everything. They're bus people every day of their lives. They pay cash. We keep our well-worn credit cards and wallets hidden in front of the pockets of our jeans. Another piece by Miss Biddy. White girl, born in the city, grew up near the county line, Catholic school, navy jumper, white blouse, nuns in round white collars. Negroes, only saw them when we went downtown on the streetcar after North Avenue when you looked around. There were hardly any white faces. When the school day was done, the bus filled up with teenagers headed deeper into the city. Their school books, Carver High or Douglas, and a stack under their arms. The boys gave up their seats to the girls. I breathed the air of segregation, sucking it in. Hardly knowing why or how it worked, this border state city of unstated rules, takeout only, segregated pools, separate schools, public or private, secular or parochial, separate movie theaters, separate stores. I graduated from saying colored people to Negroes, and still everything stayed separate. Brown-skinned bus drivers, trash men, bus boys, day cleaning ladies, white teachers, doctors, priests, Girl Scout leaders, hairdressers. My black and white TV world, Amos and Andy, Carmen McRae, Nat King Cole, Eartha Kitt, small figures with big, rich voices coming from our Sylvania. They look so small. That was the air we took into our lymphatic vessels, our blood, our reproductive organs. It was our field vision. It would be years before we'd wake or refuse to, so we had not sensed the system behind the screen. Leftovers by Lynn Vitti. The cat keeps watch by the window, stares at a sunless day. Her head turns, ears on alert, when two juncos alight on the deck. The Christmas trees, colored lights garish in the morning. Half-drunk bottles of Cabernet litter the kitchen counter. Red carnations in the table settings have gone limp. Please don't ask about the children. No longer children, now men, back at their own digs. We haven't heard from them since they packed up their gifts and leftovers in plastic tubs. They could be sleeping all day, or filling out job applications, or heaving weights at the gym. Might be watching YouTube, how to cook favorite foods of the wire. Any hope of grandchildren on the horizon is misguided. Don't ask about that either. Extreme climate, 8 degrees at 8 o'clock a.m. The president won't stop tweeting, "I watch the Junkos brave against the cold." We'll be right back. Recite one more of her pieces before we go. The title is "I Learned That Marilyn Died Today." Not Monroe, but Marilyn, the English teacher who befriended me the first day of my first job, who invited me to her 30th birthday. Marilyn, the inveterate New Yorker from West Virginia who lived in a tiny studio on the Upper East Side when nobody could afford to live there. Marilyn, who taught me how to sew pantsuits when it was radical to wear them to school. Marilyn, who had pale skin and black hair, a long face, a cutting word, who wouldn't let her students say, "This is boring," but made them say instead, "This did not reach me." Marilyn died, who slept with my ex after our breakup. He can't remember this because he never remembers anything he did before the new millennium. I lost touch with Marilyn after she met a man on the train coming back from Lake George. She called to tell me she was engaged, warned me not to get involved with a younger man. I ignored her, never saw her again. She liked dogs, a special breed. I don't recall which one. She never married because one of those beloved teachers everyone remembers forever. She told me her father used to leave her and her kid brother, locked in the car on his way home. He stopped at a bar. He'd be in there for hours drinking. I'd never heard of the Jewish alcoholic, or even Jews in West Virginia. She said they weren't observant, never went to temple, there was no bar mitzvah. She loved the theater, the students, the Upper East Side, expensive scotch, fine restaurants in Midtown and the beach. She loved Gatsby, Hamlet, Sylvia Plath, Melville, Anne Sexton, John Donne. She had the saddest face even when she smiled, black lashes against white skin. Her dark wit made me laugh and wonder, really, what was so funny about what was so sad? I wish I knew what became of her, because before her short ticket was punched. We have a caller on the line I'd like to bring in. Good evening, Erico. Yes, good evening, Erico 414.
Hey, Michael, this is Catfish.
Hello, Catfish. How are you, sir, tonight?
Doing good. How about yourself? I've been listening into your show. Sounds
pretty
good.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Maybe you can join us with some poetry.
Sure, I got some here.
Okay. Hold on one second. There's another person on the line.
All right.
Error code 781. The first three numbers are 329. You're on the air.
Yes, this is Lynn Vitti. I don't know what happened, but I'm here listening to all of it, and listening to you read my poetry is so interesting. Gee, I don't know what happened. Anyway, I'm here.
Well, everyone. I am glad to report that Lynn Vitti is here.
Yes, I'm here. I was listening and listening. I don't know what happened. But anyway, here I am.
All right. Well, let's allow Catfish to say one piece before we begin the journey. Catfish, favor us with a poem.
Okay, this one's called Mexican Walls. From my book, Dreaming with Frida Kahlo. Poems floating down like sweet snowflakes. Marijuana bricks building walls to Mexico. A 9-stone William S. Burroughs break dances in a bed of dead batteries and bullet rain. Sounds, thoughts, images, and secret Aleppo dust sprinkle through this magnum opus of words. Edgar Allan Poe, Dylan Thomas, arm wrestle. Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin play Scrabble. I thought of when Cheech and Chong got pulled over. The cop says, "Your eyes are red. Have you been smoking dope?" Cheech replies, "Your eyes are glazed. Have you been eating donuts?" That's one of my old hippie poems.
All right. That's Catfish McDowell's. He will be with us on September the 23rd. So please be aware, September the 23rd, Catfish McDarris would be here on Quintessential Listening Poetry.
That'll be the 24th.
The
2 weeks from today. 24th.
2 weeks from today. 24th. All right. 2 weeks from today.
All right. Better let your star get on here if she's been missing in the limbo here.
All right.
Resurface.
All right, Lynn, welcome to Quintessential Listening Poetry.
Well, thank you. It was just a pleasure to hear you read some of my favorite poets and then to read yours and then to have you read mine. It's so different because I'm used to reading them myself, not having someone else read. It was lovely. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure I did not give your work justice,
No.
So please read them again if you like. But let me ask you a question before we begin. What sparked your initial love of poetry?
Oh, you mean like back in the day? My mother read to me. My mother was a teacher, and she read to me and my sister all the time and started with nursery rhymes probably when we were hardly able to sit up and then continued with other kinds of poetry. And she, of course, because she was of the generation that came of age in the Depression, had to memorize a lot of poems. So often she would see something and she would just start reciting some poem by Wordsworth or you know, by Keats or by somebody I'd never heard of that brought something she had seen, brought it to mind, and she would just kind of go. And she was a teacher, so she was very, very much a storyteller and a lover of stories, but particularly in verse.
But why do you think,
I did.
Why do you? I'm sorry, please. Continue.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you, why do you think that poetry is important?
For me, poetry is a way of sort of making sense of the world and sometimes making sense of things in my own life that I find troubling often or things that I'm very delighted with. A lot of my nature poems, of which there are many, start out as an observation about a plant or a tree or an animal, and I think one of the ones you read about seeing the bird on the deck, and it sort of unfolds into a whole poem that's sort of recognizing certain stages of life. Now the kids are grown and they've gone away, and politics kind of finds its way into that too. And I just find that it's therapeutic to write about these things rather than fret about them.
Right. Very nice. Well, please share some of your work.
I'm going to read one that is sort of more of a comical poem. My new book is called The Glamorganshire Bible, and it's mostly about my maternal grandmother, who was quite a character. She also was a person who had a lot of she had a rough start in life, and she was not an easy person to be around, but she, as a grandmother, she was kind of fun. And this This poem is called Grandmother's Instructions, and almost everything in this is something that she said to me and or my sister at one point. And she probably said this to my mother when my mother was young, too. So it's called A Grandmother's Instructions. Always tighten the buttons on new clothes, especially coats. Use the wax thread. Wrap it tight around the shank. Make a few stitches. Tie it off. Cut the labels in the blouses. You don't want a stranger touching you, tucking in a stray tag when you're at the pictures or in the grocery. Dust the furniture twice a week. Polish the shiny surfaces. Use an old diaper or T-shirt. Be sure it's clean. Never put brassieres through the machine. Hand wash them. Hang them on the line. When you're on your monthlies, never soak panties in the bathroom sink. Take them down the cellar. Run cold water in a basin. Cover it with an old towel. Your father don't want to see that. When you're old enough to date, take a couple dollars, mad money, in case the boy gets fresh and you need a cab home. Keep your purse with you. Don't leave your cigarette pack on the table when you get up to dance. Someone might replace one of yours with a stick of that marijuana. Take care of your teeth. False ones are a nuisance. You've got the Welsh in you. The Welsh are the world's best singers. I'll pay for the voice lessons. I want you to sing Whispering Hope to me when I'm old and blind.
Beautifully written.
The end.
I plan to read that one, but I thought, well, maybe not.
Yeah.
Because it's so gender specific.
Yes, it is. Yeah, that was the advice. Yeah. I had one. I don't even know if I've got it in this stack. I have a couple more here. A couple nature poems, and this one is a couple years ago. There was a blood moon, and this is the story of going out to a field where we had a good view, small group of friends, to see the blood moon. We tried to see it from the soccer field at the school people want torn down. No way to rehabilitate it. Poor drainage, asbestos lurking in the walls, wrapped around pipes, Eisenhower-era construction, additions stuck on when school-aged children cropped up everywhere. It's dark. It's cold for September. The moon, a bright white orb. We wait and watch. A sliver of shadow appears at the moon's side, slowly creeps, almost imperceptibly, across the white. It's not happening fast enough for us. We want to see the pink moon, the blood moon. Huddled in this playground, we wonder why no one else is here. Are they watching the blood moon on their televisions, getting a clearer, sharper, super pink image? I pull my sweater snug around me. The night feels like the winter's breathing down our backs. The shadow drags across the moon. An hour later, the moon is pink, salmon pink, and smaller than the white moon we saw at first tonight. Out on the grass, this night, six of us in a tight knot breathe in the cold air. There won't be another blood moon for years. Will we be alive then, and if so, care enough to step outside to the porch wherever we live, tilt our heads back, marvel at the sky?
The end?
That's the end, yes.
That's the end.
Pulling through my pile here, you read a lot of my good poems. I've got a couple more. Ask a question.
The show must go on.
Yeah. That's right. I understand.
Well, let me ask this question before you recite your next piece. How does a poem begin with you, with an idea, a form, or an image?
All of the above. Sometimes it's an image. Sometimes it's an image, and often the image has to do with some of these poems that start out pretending to be nature poems and then kind of morph into something else. More often it's something someone says. And I think, oh, I write it down, and then later it kind of turns into a poem. Sometimes it's looking at an image, mostly a photograph, and particularly my family poems, I will look at. But that's what, like your poem about your father, you know, throw me a biscuit around the corner. I loved it because I could see it, and I thought I wondered whether yours started with an image or just a memory. But often I will look at a picture, and it will remind me of something that happened, and then I start to play around with that. Now, I have been accused by certain family members of who were there at the time saying, I don't remember it that way. And I say, poetic license. So, but often it is something, or somebody will make a comment and it troubles me. And I kind of worry it for a while, and then I try to work it out through a poem. And I think some of these poems that you read, because I'm starting on this whole series about what it was like to be growing up in the 50s and then have these quick changes in the 60s, when I was living in a town south of the Mason-Dixon line where segregation was a way of life, and just watching all of this happen and starting to kind of figure it out. And a lot of those in the poems trying to recreate that kind of sense of not being clueless, really, without overtelling it. So that's something I'm working on.
Well, that particular piece in terms of the segregation in the city of Baltimore really resonated with me. You brought up a lot of images.
I have another one that I did not send in that batch that I realized later I should have included, which, if you don't mind, I would read.
Oh, yeah, please read what.
And I
like.
Read this at my old high school, Mercy High School, about a year ago at an all-school assembly in Baltimore, and it was all-white girls when I was there, and now it's quite a diverse group. And I could see, hear all these, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, and they just were listening like, oh, my gosh, that was what it was like. So it's called Clifton Park, and Clifton Park is a city park in Baltimore. So I will just read the poem. This poem harkens back to when I was very young, and my mother, I did ask her while she was still alive one time, and she did not remember taking me there. Clifton Park. I demanded that my mother take me back to the park with the three swimming pools. Summer was so much hotter then. At night, fans cooled us down. In the days, we moved slowly, drank iced tea or Kool-Aid. I asked her to take me to the city park with the three pools, all concrete-bottomed, concrete-sided, the baby pool, the pool for grown-ups, the middle one just right for me. I waded cautiously into the shallow end, watched boys dive into my pool, swim like fish through cold water. Their skin was dark, their hair in dark little whorls in perfect patterns. I pestered my mother to take me back. She shook her head. Why, I asked, why not? All summer, I contemplated the three pools, the boys calling out challenges to one another, shoving, laughing, scrambling onto the pool's concrete edges. Why, I kept asking, why don't we go back there? Polio, she said, and too many city people. I understood polio, but the rest of it only confused me. What could be better than to be near those boys, their skin glistening, their shouts, name-calling, bragging, in a pool in our city? The end.
All right. I could see it. Honestly, I could feel it. Yes.
Yeah, I could see it, and it was the 50s, and it was the season. It was the years of polio, but I didn't accept that answer. I've got another. Yeah, I don't know how we want to load up with these, but I've got another
series.
Please. Okay, please. Matinee at the Shore. And this is an Ocean City poem. It's self-explanatory. At the candy store near the whitewash movie house, we spent our nickels on cream caramels and fireballs, stuffed the small bags of sticky sweets into our pockets. We pulled our T-shirts down to hide the evidence. Don't go on the Ferris wheel or the Tilt-A-Whirl. Sit downstairs at that movie house, the mothers warned, as my older friend and I set out to walk to Division Street. Duane was a tough girl from Dundalk, sassy, full of questions. I was 3 years younger, only half listened to the mother's rules. Separate sections, balconies, different customs down here. Ensconced in her booth, the ticket lady asked our ages. Duane hesitated. She was tall, looked 12. That meant an adult ticket, 50 cents. All but our last quarter each was gone. We were lucky that day. The woman didn't fuss. She tore two gray tickets off the roll, pushed them through the slot, never smiled at us. I followed Duane's long, skinny legs up the wooden staircase, dragged my hand on rough, painted wallboards as we went. The candy bag bulged in my pocket. Laughter met us at the landing. Empty seats surrounded us. I didn't like to sit far from others in a dark theater, even for comedies. It's the rule, Duane said. We can't mix. We'd already broken one law, no candy inside the movies. We might as well break another. But I didn't say a word. After the gray newsreel, the screen turned to color. Every soul on the balcony cheered. Duane cheered, too. But I slid down low in my seat, stuffed another caramel into my mouth. That's that one.
Where do you write?
Oh, that's a good question. I have been known to write in a Starbucks or a Pete's, you know, busy coffee shop where it's chaos. I've been known to at meetings start to write a poem. I hope my pastor isn't here listening. She might be because she's a poetry fan. I have been known to jot a few things down on the church bulletin. You know, it's like something occurred to me. I've got one around here somewhere. Jennifer, if you're listening, I've got it somewhere. I'll show it to you. That's how they often start. Now, I will write at a desk, and I often write at the kitchen counter or at the dining room table, which my spouse refers to as Lynn's office because I just sort of spread out down there. But I do not write in my teaching office. The door is always open, and people are always walking in. But I like to write in the kitchen or in the dining room mostly. But often I'm just taking notes that will turn into something later. And I usually write out longhand first and then type it up and then revise it and revise it and revise it and revise it. And even when it's in a book, a chapbook or a book, and I think, oh, I don't like that word. So I revise many, many times.
Right. Well, please continue with your work, sharing your work.
Okay. Here's one about my mother called My Mother on My Cousin's Wedding Day. And this was my older cousin who was married probably around 1959 or so. My mother on my cousin's wedding day. Children weren't invited. That wasn't fair. I was 13, had never seen a wedding except on television. She opened a flat box of stockings, pulled them on gently, fastened them to her girdle. I watched her pull the beige lace dress over her head, shake it down her slender frame, gently push her arms through the sleeves. I zipped the dress closed. I climbed onto her bed, mesmerized by the lace sheath. Paid full price, too, she murmured. Coral high-heeled pumps, matching clutch bags, sparkling costume jewelry. She leaned toward the mirror to put on her lipstick, coral, like the shoes. From a department store box, she withdrew an ivory hat, broad-brimmed in the front, covered with tulle. My father waited downstairs in his favorite chair, trying not to sweat in the August heat. I followed them out the front door, sat on the porch steps, the concrete hot on my thighs. The green and white fins of our Chevy disappeared down the street. She was 45. I knew she'd be the prettiest, best-dressed lady there. She wore the lace dress again, over and over, and the coral shoes. But the hat stayed in the back of the closet for years, till one day the square box went to Goodwill, because nobody wore hats anymore.
You know, I hear that family as well as nature seem to be predominant themes, if I'm correct. Are there other predominant themes in your work?
Well, there's a lot of politics in some of my work, and it's gotten me into some trouble with people who disagree with my politics. So, sometimes I sneak it in. This is a poem about Baltimore as well, and Baltimore is a city that's gone through oh so many changes. Industry was always big in Baltimore, and when the steel mills closed and some of the other industries packed up and left or became obsolete, things really took a bad turn. And I think there's a great line in The Wire in the second season where one of the longshoremen said, "We used to bank things in the city, now we just put our hands in the other guy's pocket." This poem is about my sense of how much the city changed. And I left when I was about 19 and went to school in New York. So I have many titles for this poem. I was calling it Up, Down, Downtown, but I think the new title is something like What I Think Happened. And the football fans will know what I'm talking about at the end here. Downtown disappeared just as we packed up our childhood things, went to college, resisted the pull of home, succumbed to a quest for experience, the exhilarating scent of independence. We didn't know a thing about birth control, weren't ready for sex, spent hours gazing at fashion photos of formal dresses for proms or military balls at the Southern men's schools. We traded and borrowed long white gloves, clutch bags, fake pearls, monitored our alcohol intake, fended off advances. We watched foreign films with subtitles. Uptown, in what our surviving newspaper calls a blue-collar suburb, we practiced our driving, parallel parking, took our road tests. City buses were for losers. We were meant for better things. Downtown, the department stores packed up Tony exurbs. The fancy downtown steakhouses grew tired or empty as their patrons died off or got too old to travel or began to lose their teeth. The shopper's favorite drugstore closed its counter service, the locale for tuna sandwiches on white toast, chips on the side, 50 cents. The management eschewed sit-ins by agitators from the campuses. Undergrads in nice chinos and V-neck sweaters. Secretaries and file clerks tottering in heels across cobblestones over trolley tracks, fine leather bags in hand, once ubiquitous, descending from yellow city buses each morning, vanished almost overnight, along with the appellation Miss. The boy we celebrated because he could drink a whole case of beer and not pass out was drafted into 5th Infantry Division C Company, died in Quang Tri Province, the image of his round face, his beetle haircut, so faint now. We traced his name on the wall in D.C. Downtown, the cranes went to work making a shiny marketplace in the footprint of the old harbor. The spice factory migrated to the county, dispersed cinnamon air among the cul-de-sacs. Downtown blocks burned, were abandoned, boarded up. Gone were the steel mills, the port artifacts. Then the hometown football team sneaked out of town at midnight. The moving vans headed west to the city of Indians. That was the beginning of the end.
Do you think that you were meant to be a poet? Do you think you were meant to be a poet or a writer?
I've always written. I was an English teacher. I've always written. But poetry, I had a long intermission. I wrote in high school. I wrote in junior high. I wrote in high school. I wrote in college. And I wrote a little bit in my 20s. But once I started teaching and once I started having children, I did not write for years. Write maybe a poem a year. And I had an interesting thing happen, and I can't have this discussion end without telling this story. When I was 16, my friend and I went to a coffee house, literally a coffee house, where folk singers came and played the guitar and sang folk songs in Baltimore, where they served cider and apple juice and Coca-Cola and no alcoholic drinks. And we did not go to hear the music. We went because some boy that we knew said, "You like poetry, you should go hear this guy read his poetry, he's really good." So down we went, and we heard this, we were juniors in high school, we heard this young man was in his 20s, very slight, not very tall young man with glasses, wearing corduroy jeans and reciting his poetry, and his name was Sam Cornish. And Sam had a real presence and made an impact on me. He was the first person I ever heard who was a poet who recited his poetry. Well, life went on. I kind of forgot about him and often wondered what happened to him. And one day I was in a well-known bookstore in the Boston area. It was an old warehouse at the time. They've since moved to a newer, smaller place. But it was a big old warehouse, and it was called New England Mobile Book Fair. And they had used books and new books, and I just, you know, pot around there and buy used books and remainders and so on. And one day I was there with my husband, and I hear the loudspeaker say, Sam Cornish, please report to the front desk. There's somebody here who has something for you. And I thought, I ran to the front desk, and I said, Sam Cornish? They said, yeah. I said, where is he? He said, oh, he's down there in that room. And I went down, and here he was. This is 40 years later or more. And I went over to him, and I said, I introduced myself, and I said, I heard you read at the Fog Cutter Lo these many years ago, and it made quite an impression on me. And he said, well, he said, you've made my day. Now, I give these poetry workshops in Boston at the library. You should come. So I went home and looked him up. He was Poet Laureate of Boston, and I didn't even know it. He'd been here all along, working at New England Mobile Book Fair, but writing poetry and publishing and teaching workshops. And I went to one of his workshops, and I was hooked. And the people in the workshops came from all different ages and all different places. We had people in their 80s. We had people in their 20s. And you read your poem, and everyone told you what they thought of it, and they were very frank about what they thought of the poems. And then at the end, Sam would put in his 2 cents, and after about the fifth or sixth class, he said to me, Ms. Vitti, I want to come up here after class. I want to talk to you. And he said, you need to send out your work. And I thought, what? This is only 5 years ago. So he got me going. He started. And unfortunately, we lost Sam just a couple weeks ago as another Baltimore-born poet, Afa Michael Weaver, said he's gone to take a walk with Aretha. His memorial service was on the same day as Aretha Franklin's and John McCain's, and he influenced so many people. So, you know, Sam, if you're listening, thank you very much. He and my high school teachers were my real inspirations to start writing and keep writing. So I do owe him a great debt. He really gave me that push I needed. So had to wait, late vocation.
It's only been in the last 5 years?
Well, I have some stuff. I've been pulling out some things that I wrote when I was in my 20s, and I'm some of them I think can be salvaged and rewritten. But I think what's happened is I've found my voice more. I think the stuff I wrote before, it was good, but it was a little bit, for me, too academic. I mean, I don't think poetry should just be for people who are in graduate school to study. I think it should be. That's why one of the reasons that, even though I like all the classical poets, and you actually mentioned one of my favorite poets, Lucille Clifton, when you read her work, I like it to be a voice speaking. And I've been pleased that some of the people that I went to school with or friends of mine in this area who bought my first chapbook, they said, oh, I don't usually read poetry, but I understand this. And that makes me feel good. I don't want it to be so mysterious that my readers can't figure it out. I think it should be for the people, accessible. So.
Well, let's take a short break, and we'll be right back, all right?
Okay.
My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Lynn Vitti, sharing her work, her beautiful, beautiful work. I feel your work. I see it. I see it. The imagery is incredible. So I want to thank you for sharing your work. Do you have other pieces for us tonight?
I do. I have one that it's one of my favorites, and this is something, I don't know where this came out of. I've been working on a long piece of fiction, and I think to a certain extent it brought up a lot of, it's set in the sort of 60s and earlier, and it brought up some childhood memories. This is a boy who's his mother and father were my godparents, and we were very close. He was a year younger than me, and I think the poem kind of speaks for itself. I don't think I need to say anything more about it, but he was a family friend and a year younger than me and a very, very smart guy. So this is, and his name was Dan. So this is in memory of Dan, and it's called Engineer. He was the boy who loved trains of all kinds and trolleys back when they still ran along the roads to Kearney and Towson, all the way to the Route's End, Woodlawn or Windsor Hills, places I knew only as names on placards, black print on white in the front of those streetcars or white on black on the turning signage at the side of the car, Irvington, Forest Park, each mysterious terminus. He was the boy who set up the Lionel trains on the sheet of plywood painted green to look like fields, trains that ran past a station, a school, a town hall, fields with tiny metal cows that grazed on painted wood. He wore the motorman's cap or the engineer's striped cap, stacked glossy train magazines on his bookshelf, talked of nothing but steam locomotives, electric trains, old straw-seated trolleys, bus routes through Baltimore, till his world expanded and he learned the subway lines in New York and Boston, discontinued private companies, public utilities, anything, so long as there were cars carrying people or empty cars late at night or in the first run out of the car barn. Car barn. When was the last time someone said those words or cared about car barns? Now he's often confused, often unsure of how to log into email, uncertain which day it is or where his wife goes when she leaves the house. Someone said the cops came one day. He might have done something wrong. They pushed him down into the squad car as he yelled, "Talk to my wife. Please call my wife. She'll explain." It's nothing like that, we later heard. It's his mind. It's slipping. He fears he can't remember things, won't remember the stops on the number 19 line, won't remember where they built the diesel-powered buses we rode to school, their fumes sweet and nauseating all at once. When we were young, he let me throw the switch and start the train running. Sometimes he let me drop a pellet into the engine's smokestack and gray smoke, pungent like incense, poured out of the engine as it clicked along the tracks. Sometimes he let me throw the switch so the train turned off onto a loop that led to the round table where he did repairs, touched up the paint here and there, let the engine rest. Heads together, we leaned over the platform, the tracks in the train world he created. Lights slanted in through the basement window. "Look," he said, flicking on the red signal. He slowed the train to a halt, pointed to the coal car. "We need more fuel," he said. He threw the switch then. I thought he was king of the railroads. And that's the end of
that.
That was incredible.
Let me ask this question.
Thank you.
What have you learned about yourself from your writing experiences? Who are you as a result of writing? Who are you now?
Well, I think I'm a person who is older, officially old, as I like to say, who is looking back and realizing that there are certain things in my childhood and my adolescence and my 20s that I can use to tell a story in a poem, and it kind of I don't know how to say this, captures that world for readers who have no access to that any other way. I mean, they can read history about something, but I try to distill my experience so that somebody who's not of that age can relate to it. And I teach 18, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, and it's very gratifying to me when they say, "Oh, I think I understand what that was like." Because it's really, I mean, there are no computers in my poems unless they're very contemporary. A lot of these poems are looking back at a time that's so over. It's back in the day, way back in the day. I think I feel like I need to kind of tell that story. It's a drive, I guess. Before I die, I need to tell that story.
Understandable. You know, when people hear your work, they usually, I'm sure, want more. What's next for you as a poet?
Right now I am working on this rather long, I don't know what to call it. It's all of these poems about the consciousness of race and class and in my upbringing and how things have changed, and then unhappily how things have not changed. I feel sometimes like, didn't we do this before? Didn't we do this 35 years ago? Oh, I guess we're not done yet. And this notion of trying to figure out how we as a society deal with these issues, which are economic and political, as well as matters of race and class. I don't want to write about this like I'm preaching, but I'm trying to tell a story that what's underneath of it, the subtext, is trying to tell a truth. And so I'm working really hard on that, and I'm also trying to work more with tighter forms, and that's a challenge for me because I notice in my work when I look at it, I had some rhymes there. I didn't even know that. Well, that's great, but I would like to write in tighter forms, and I've been trying to write more sonnets, which is something I'm working on now. And that's pretty much it. I mean, what I'd like to do is to pull together a full-length book. I've got two chapbooks, and I've got a lot of poems that have appeared here and there in magazines, but that's my challenge. And, of course, there are, 10 or 15 really awesome places that I would be thrilled. I could die a happy woman if I got a poem published in one of those places, but I'm not, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but I'm going to work on it. A full collection,
A full collection?
Pardon?
That would really,
yeah,
that would
full
be really
collection.
Nice
like
full collection.
Yeah, I've got
well,
it. I've
got.
I'm looking at the manuscript. It's on the floor right here.
All right. One last question. You have,
yes, sir.
One more piece that you could share with us before we close out.
I do. I've got one. It's a good closer, and it's actually the first poem in my book. It's called Salad Days. And this is from Baltimore Girls, my first book. Salad days. This is a term that, comes from Shakespeare. Your salad days are when you're green and young and fresh.
Yes.
Salad days. We lived at home. We're always home for dinner. We thought we dressed like women, but only when we peeled off the school uniforms and slid into plaid kilts, blouses with Peter Pan collars and circle pins, loafers, on Friday night for a church hall dance. We thought we knew everything, though we only knew everything about things we read in books or heard on the bus or on the street. We read magazines to learn how to flirt. Being sophisticated meant smoking Benson and Hedges. We wondered how old we'd have to be to drink at a cousin's wedding. Our mothers thought our world was crazy, too much Orbison and Presley, then, in a word, James Brown, the man in the orange cape, and the Beatles who made us scream, or the subversive Dylan who questioned us, how does it feel to be on your own? When our mothers wanted us to be safe, take the bus to school, be home on time, no drinking, no smoking, study hard, go to college, find a nice boy, get married, stay in town, our town, which changed and burned again. Some of us left, and those who stayed didn't always follow the playbook. We are neither who we were when we were 16, nor are we different from who we were inside, even though we've tried like crazy to speak up, grow up, let go, not judge, relax, achieve, kick back, question, breathe, believe, not believe. Now we size ourselves up against the dreams and goals and fantasies we had as girls, the plans we spoke of, the ones we hid. Back then, we didn't say it's all good, but it is. The whole journey, the paths and detours, all good, all worth something, the living of it, the becoming, never stepping into the same river twice.
If I wanted to purchase your work, where would I go?
Well, the best thing to do is to email me, because I've got a stack of author's copies here, and when I sell them, I give the proceeds to scholarships at Mercy High School in Baltimore. So LVITI@Wellesley.edu, or they can go to my blog, which is called stillinschool.wordpress.com, and the information is there as well.
I'd like to thank you for being our guest, and I hope that you'll return.
Thank you very much, Michael. This has been just delightful. I've had so much fun doing this, so I really appreciate the opportunity. I do.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad.
And then next like time, I'll figure out what happened with my headset.
Well,
the technology. Well, Margaret Mead used to say the technology will break down and you just have to punt. So I guess that's what we did. So.
That's what we did, and it turned out well.
Okay.
Thank you again.
Well, thank you
have
very
a great
much.
Evening.
Very much. All right. Thanks again. You too. Good night.
All right. Good night, everybody. Good night, everybody.